TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. David Keith, A Case for Climate Engineering. Harvard climate scientist David Keith makes the case that global warming and CO2 poisoning have become so severe that dramatic measures have to be researched immediately and applied by 2020. He is suggesting spraying particles from airplanes into the stratosphere to create a haze that will reduce solar radiation. He names possible substances, including aluminum. However, his material of choice is sulfuric acid, because it mimics volcanic explosions. He admits that such global intervention will damage the life-protecting ozone layer, cause droughts and floods, and will do nothing to resolve the expanding damage to the planet by still rising CO2 emissions. He says that we need to artificially cool the Earth because we are too slow to cut back on CO2 pollution. And that once begun, the spraying of aerosols cannot be stopped for the next 50 years, because removing the protective haze would be a dramatic shock to the world. Professor Keith denies that real-life experimentation of spraying from airplanes is occurring, in spite of the observations of so-called chemtrails all over the world. He does, however, admit that spraying from airplanes is easy and inexpensive. All you need is an airfield and a couple of planes, he says, and that such activity would be very difficult to detect. This and more is written up in his book, A Case for Climate Engineering, published in October 2013 at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The prestigious Boston Review gave the book a release event that was videotaped, and the audio for this radio program comes from their website. Professor David Keith was introduced by MIT political scientist Kenneth Oyer.
Professor David Keith is professor of public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he's also a professor of applied physics in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at Harvard. He previously was teaching at the University of Calgary in Canada, and before that he spent time at Carnegie Mellon. He has a PhD from MIT in physics, and he has a new book, outstanding book, important book, which came out this week. Am I right?
Yes.
Hot off the presses. So you're all very current. And I will turn it over to David.
Thank you very much. I want to try and keep this resume short. I think this topic is one that does and should raise really hard questions. And I think a lot of the fun, at least my fun, of giving these talks is hearing the questions people have, even the really hard ones, or maybe especially the really hard ones. So I look forward to that. I'll start with kind of the most sort of technocratic, brutally simple statement of what we could do, with no commentary about whether or not it's a good thing. So if you wanted to cut the rate of climate change, which might mean change in temperature or change in precipitation, for example, over essentially the whole world, starting in 2020, in half, cut the rate of change in half, we could do it. We would start by putting sulfuric acid in the stratosphere, using aircraft. You'd start with probably two aircraft. There's your commercial, modified commercial business jets, Gulfstream business jets would work. And you'd gradually have to keep putting more and more in because, of course, we're putting more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is warming it up. And you could imagine a slow ramp where each year you put a little more sulfur in. At the end of 50 years, you'd be putting about 1 million tons a year of sulfur. But you would have cut the rate of climate change by half over that entire half century. And then you obviously can't keep doing this forever. You can't keep putting more sulfur in the stratosphere forever. You could ramp yourself back down to zero over the next 50 years, and the result then would be to essentially slow down the overall rate of climate change compared to what it would have been and have a real impact from what we now know from the climate models, or suspect, a real impact in lessening the climate impacts for natural people, natural ecosystems, and for vulnerable populations over the next half century. That's sort of the basics of what one could do. I guess two things to say about it. There was essentially a taboo about talking and thinking about this for a long time. So all the science is, in a sense, kind of new and therefore very uncertain. So there's some, you know, significant potential that what I told you isn't correct. It's my view about the current science. I think it's a fair view of the current science, but lots of new stuff could come out. There are a whole bunch of deep risks and uncertainties. But to me, the deepest risks and uncertainties are mostly about how we use the technology, not about how it works on its own. A little bit of background. This idea is actually not new at all. So it's been known since the 1960s at least. So the beginning of the kind of modern origin of understanding the climate problem as we now conceive it was in the early 60s. The first major report to a US president was to President Johnson. And at about the same time was the first thinking about these ideas. And if you look at the kind of history of the consensus science report that dealt with this, like the MIT study of man's impact on the environment, women didn't have an impact back then, and that was one in 69 and one in 70, or the Energy and Climate National Academy report of 1977, or the later reports, all of them dealt with this topic as one of the ways we might manage the climate problem. But then starting with the kind of IPCC era, as climate became more politicized, people were, I think, frankly scared that talking about this would that it acts as a kind of band-aid. It doesn't deal with the underlying problem of the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere, and that by doing this, it might kind of provide a band-aid that would encourage people not to cut emissions as they should, in a sense, although the morality here is not so clear. And so the last decades after that, there was essentially no research. There is still no organized research program in the US government about this, so there now are programs in Germany and the UK. The taboo was broken in 2006 when Paul Crutzen published an article that said actually much what many people like me had already published, but he was a Nobel Prize winner, had won his Nobel Prize for chemistry, and one of the key potential risks was the loss of the ozone layer. It's possible that some ways you would do this would accelerate ozone loss, and I think that Crutzen was suddenly taken seriously, both because the time was right to take it seriously, and also because nobody could imagine that he didn't understand that risk. He was very blunt about it. I'd say there are kind of three key technical characteristics that in turn have really big impacts for public policy. One is that it's fast. So if you want to stop climate change from the carbon dioxide we're accumulating in the air, it's a very slow process because the carbon dioxide that we're putting in the air its effects last for millennia. So that means the climate change we see today isn't really due to the CO2 we emitted in the last year, it's due to the CO2 we've emitted, you know, integrated out since the dawn of industrial civilization. And that is very different from other pollutants. So if you think about the air pollution that we make in industrial society that kills about 2 million people a year worldwide, if we did a better job that we ought to do of regulating those emissions more seriously, if we could install the scrubbers, the actual air pollutants would last in the atmosphere only a couple days. That's how long kind of typical air pollutants last in the atmosphere. But carbon is not like that at all. And what that basically means is that, it's sort of the central reason why the climate change problem is so hard politically, cutting emissions today of carbon dioxide, which is, to be clear, what I think we ought to do, will have very little positive benefit to people who actually do the cutting. They'll incur costs. The benefits all go to their grandkids, which I think is something we should care about, but it's not an easy political sell. And also goes to everybody's grandkids, not just the grandkids of the people spending the money. The fact that this is fast allows you to get some benefits in the near term. And that is, I think, important both physically. It's important because there's real benefits you can deliver. You can actually reduce the risks for people in this generation, which is hard to do otherwise. And it's important politically. It's cheap. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing in this context. It is so cheap that the right way to think about it is the cost is zero. There are big risks. There are big impacts. There are big potential benefits. Figuring out the balance of those risks and benefits is hard because they fall on different people at different times, but the actual direct cost of doing it is small enough that a good approximation is zero, sort of $1 billion a year class money. And what that means is it allows the possibility of unilateral action. So unlike the problem of cutting carbon emissions, where we have to get most of the world to agree to cut carbon emissions because everybody's emissions contribute, in this problem, the problem in many ways, the problem of international control, because essentially any nation that wanted to could go purchase the hardware to do this, that you could have Embraer or Hindustani Aeronautics do the hardware. It's not just a thing that the rich countries could do. So huge potential cost, huge potential kind of cost benefit ratio, if you want to think that way, but also giant implications. Giant implications running right up to warfare. I mean, the power of these technologies to suddenly change the Earth's climate with that kind of leverage is truly frightening and should be. Third characteristic is it's uncertain. We don't know exactly how well it will work, and it's also hard to know how well it is working. So if you start doing this and do it slowly, you can't actually detect accurately what's happened. So you may think there are benefits, but it's hard to attribute climate changes to particular causes. I mean, just as right now, we can't say with confidence that particular weather events are due to CO2-induced climate change. We know in general what we expect from CO2-induced climate change, but direct attribution is hard. So it would be hard here as well. As I said, I think that the central hard problems are all social. I think we'll talk about those in Q&A. Who decides? You know, what political system have legitimacy to make these decisions about kind of where to set the global thermostat? This will, without a doubt, be used politically by forces that would like not to have emissions controls, an excuse not to have them. And most people now working on it actively, people like me, are in fact kind of greenies who spend a lot of time working on emissions controls. So that's not what I want, but I don't control technology, I just work on it. The way it will be undoubtedly used is partly for that. And one of the obvious political questions is, maybe you could uninvent the technology, but I don't know how to do that, how specifically to couple together political moves to enact regulations on CO2 emissions with moves to use this technology, or at least to study it. Under what conditions is it ethical to do this or not? How does it change our relationship with the natural world? I'm going to talk about that. That's a particular thing I personally care about a lot and do some work on as an academic. So a little digression into that. I think it's fair to say that our mainstream arguments that are made in kind of public fora about environmental protection are increasingly technocratic. So if you're a scientist who works on the rainforest and you've spent your career working on some epiphyte, and you just love that part of the rainforest wherever you've been working in Brazil or wherever, and you go talk to the powers that be, most typically nowadays what you're going to do is talk about the carbon holding capacity of the rainforest, or the way it changes hydrology, or you're going to talk about the potential to yield wonder drugs from all its genetic diversity. And you might bundle those things up and call it all ecosystem services. I think this is, there is some kind of ecosystem service. We derive value from nature. But I think this grossly understates and undercounts how people actually care about it. And I think people actually say that. It's clear you can do kind of tests with them by asking them questions that they don't mean it at all. I mean, if they really meant that was the reason they liked the rainforest, then they presumably be overjoyed if I invented a carbon-sucking machine that was more effective than the rainforest, and we just cut the rainforest down and replaced it with a carbon-sucking machine and a, you know, gene sequencing machine. But obviously that's not correct. People actually like it because they like it for reasons that are separate from its direct utility. And I think this does link to geoengineering, that in thinking about why we should care about climate change, and I think one fun thing in a way about this geoengineering topic is it forces us to re-examine at some extent what we're doing here. What is the climate change goal? And I think part of the goal, at least for me, and I think for many people, but they don't say it enough, is preserving parts of the natural world for reasons that are not just about the direct economic threat to us. So how to think about geoengineering in this context, this kind of ecocentric view? Well, there's an obvious argument kind of against geoengineering that would say that the idea that you're going to try and make nature more natural to kind of protect the natural world by artificially turning it into a machine by having the whole climate regulated seems on the face of it completely nutty. And I don't think that's a dumb position. I think you could actually go down and defend that position and argue that you should never do this. I don't think there's a clear answer here. But I think you can also make the opposite case. This may, in fact, allow us to do a better job limiting environmental impacts than any other thing we could do, especially impacts that will not otherwise be limited by economic interests, like protecting high Arctic ecosystems. And this sounds kind of over-promotional, but I don't think it's nutty. You can think of this as kind of a restoration ecology, that is the deliberate ways that people try and restore ecosystems at a planetary scale. This solar radiation management or solar geoengineering will not work alone as a sole solution to climate change. You have to restrain emissions, but restraining emissions alone will not solve the climate problem on its own anyway, because of the accumulation of CO2 in the air. And it's quite possible that the combination of those things will do, in some measures, a better job of preserving the natural world we love than either one alone. So to say a little bit more about what I actually, you know, what advocate we do, I would advocate a serious research program. As I said, there's been a kind of taboo. There is, at this point, a few little bits of federal money, but there is no research program, no kind of active program manager or group of program managers who are responsible for actually acting in the public interest to do this. And indeed, for a while, quite a lot of the money moving to do research, and this was moving through my office as a gift from Bill Gates, a few million bucks has moved through that way. And I don't think that's the, I'm very happy to have that gift. It's a purely philanthropic gift. There's no commercial strings attached, but I don't think that's the right public policy answer. The right public policy answer is we have a serious public research program, as is beginning to happen in Europe. I think that program should, in every way that it can, be internationalized, because a bunch of the risks here, as I said, have to do with trust between nations, and the research program can play a role, not a central role, but a role in building up communication between nations whose interests may diverge. It should be publicly funded. We should try and stamp out, I think, from solar radiation management, private commercial interests. And the reason is that in some cases where you really need the power of your free enterprise to sort of drive down costs, you want to have it in. But in this case, the costs are so cheap, there's no particular advantage to making it a little bit cheaper. So we don't really need that kind of power of private enterprise to drive costs down. And we really do need the public scrutiny and transparency that I think best, though imperfectly, comes in a public program. I also think it's really important that it be diverse. I mean, the underlying thing here is we want, I think, to go down the road of actually exploring this technology, learning a lot more about how well it would work, what the risks are, et cetera. But we'd like to do that without falling in this kind of slippery slope where we commit ourselves to do it. And that can happen with kinds of institutional lock-in. And so the things I'm proposing are ways to try and minimize the chance of that lock-in. I also would advocate we don't do this through one big centralized government agency, because such things have their own kind of will to live and propagate themselves even when their mission is worthless, as we all know. So I'd advocate that we actually fund a bunch of different centers, which many of which are actually focused on finding all the ways it will not work, and some are focused on, you know, engineering ways to figure out how it will work. Why should we do this? I mean, the basic evidence, I mean, you know, why should we talk about this? Like, really, in a sense, nutty idea that we're going to add a pollutant that, to be clear, will kill people, into the atmosphere to kind of counteract the effect of other pollutants, when everybody's sort of natural first reaction screams out that we should just cut the original pollutant. Well, first of all, as I said, the lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere means that it's just not as simple as cutting the original pollutant. And while there are certainly ways to decarbonize our energy system, and I spent a lot of my career working on them, it's not like we just need the political will and we decarbonize it tomorrow. Even a very substantial, really, you know, at this point, politically inconceivable effort to cut emissions would have trouble bringing emissions to zero in half a century. The evidence from climate models, basic atmospheric physics observations, suggest pretty strongly that the benefits of this in terms of reduced risks of climate change are greatly, the benefits are much bigger than the direct risks of doing this. That's as I read the tea leaves, as we know it now. I think ignorance is dangerous. I think that we cannot, in fact, uninvent the technology. There is a chance people will want to use it in a time of crisis. And we're, I think, much better off if we start now beginning to learn more about it technically and also begin to think hard about how we govern it so we don't make all the decisions at the last minute. I think I'll close there. Thank you very much. Happy to look at questions.
The questions to David that I really pose without having clear answers. Research, we agree. We want to see research on this. At this point, would be useful to know a little bit more about the insurance policy. But exactly what research would you do and on what scale? Two, who should make the decisions on this? Three, who should conduct it? And four, how do we go about evaluating the results? So there are a whole series of questions on research. The other questions were a little bit more on the politics of use. And in fact, is unilateralism a big problem here, and where does it go? Where does it go in terms of potential conflict? Where does it go in terms of offsets or neutralization strategies? And when you then talk about a world of increasing CO2 levels, increasing methyl bromide levels, pressure, if you will, greenhouse gas warming, if that's taking place and the oceans are acidifying, and then uncoordinated conflict over geoengineering were to take place, what form would it take and what effects might it have? So let me stop there. turn it back to David, and then we can move to the floor for questions and comments. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I've calculated it'll take me about 4 days to answer all those questions. Let me answer, give you, hazard some of the answers on the research. I don't think a huge program is warranted, especially when there's very controversial research and a bunch of noise out there. There's some researchers who have what I would characterize as pretty loony ideas. I think if you funded a kind of monster research program, a kind of Manhattan project, which is what some of my colleagues propose, it would quickly fall under its own weight. It would get too big, it would fund a bunch of stuff that was crazy, there'd be congressional investigations of it, and it would collapse.
There will be congressional investigations no matter what.
So I propose something that kind of ramps up pretty slowly. To give you a sense of numbers, I mean, I would start at just a few million bucks a year. So I would start there and kind of ramp myself up to tens of millions over a decade. I think something quite modest like that could do a lot. And part of the reason I should say why you can accomplish a lot for that little money is fundamentally a huge amount of the underlying science technology is already the core of the atmospheric sciences that are dealing with this problem anyway. It's just redirecting them to deal with understanding and evaluating the risks and efficacy, and those are the two things we'd focus on, the risks and efficacy of these ideas. And in a sense, likewise for actually the related public policy. So there's a big effort that, you know, Ken is part of, and the social sciences trying to understand the public policy dimensions of climate change, and the same people doing that, I think, can effectively work on this problem. I think the question about who reviews is great. I mean, I think IPCC is weaker in my own experience. I should say I dropped out of this round of IPCC. I was writing the geoengineering section, and I felt it was so bureaucratic and boring, I quit. I think that we do need something else. I think it may be a case where national academies are actually better, or the Inter-Academy Council, or some, this is a union of different national academies of science, are effectively now more credible in IPCC. We have some specific suggestions that I made as part of a group that the Bipartisan Policy Center convened about how the U.S. government might do it. And I think the key thing would be to have some civil society organizations brought in to oversee some parts of that research. So you would have research happening in different agencies, but you'd have some body convened. There are various specific ways we could do that that I don't need to go into here, but basically a body convened that would have a range of civil society organizations, environmental groups, labor groups, whatever, industry, that would at least give a more open forum for discussing the overall direction and scope of the research program than if it was kind of purely government proposed. I don't think that answers all those questions, but it's kind of a rough step. Technically, I should say, I am now, myself and Jim Anderson at Harvard, are actively proposing an in situ experiment, a physical experiment. And in that, we're pushing beyond what most of our colleagues are comfortable with. We think it's a wise idea, but most of my colleagues, I would say, do not. And that would be an experiment that would release of order a kilogram of sulfuric acid into the stratosphere and measure some specific chemical reactions in a cloud for 24 hours, and also release about 100 kilograms of water. And tell you more about the details of that, but it's probably not appropriate here. And we think that would go after understanding some particular pieces of the risks and efficacy of this. But there are lots of people who I respect who think that we're really being cowboys to try proposing such a thing. I want to come back on the question you didn't ask, but I want to say, in terms of broad power politics, it's very hard to get away from the idea that if this technology really existed and was tested and well accepted, that to get away from the fundamental fact that you'd have less pressure to cut emissions. I think at sort of a national and power politics level, I think that that is pretty much a done deal. But I don't think it's so simple when you think about an individual level, and the individual level in the end does have a link to what national politics do. So. Why are people so passive about dealing with the climate problem? There's a lot of reasons for that that aren't simple, that may, among other things, have to do with people's sense that it's actually unsolvable, a kind of fatalism. And so if you actually take individual citizens, who ultimately do have some impact, and not in a simple way, on democratic governments, and you tell them about this idea, the question of whether that makes them more or less eager to see action on cutting emissions is an empirical question. People have begun to look at it. And the early data from actual experiments, people trying to take people and ask them these questions, points in both directions. But it's not, and it gets two sorts of reactions. One reaction is, oh, we've got a tech fix for this. Well, now we can sit back and just keep driving our SUVs. But the other reaction is, well, if the scientific boffins are so worried that they're proposing this kind of nutcase thing, then they must have really meant that there's a problem, and maybe we should get more serious about dealing with the problem so we don't deal with this. And there are actually even political versions. So I think I have now supervised the first PhD student in economics to get a PhD working on this topic. And he had an early paper that looked at kind of an asymmetric game theory world that showed in some cases you got more CO2 mitigation, more emissions cuts from countries in the presence of geoengineering than without it. And that's true when you have asymmetric countries. Essentially, if one country really hates the idea that the other country is going to geoengineer and is actually worried that they're going to lose a lot by geoengineering, and they know that that other country is going to act independently and they'll geoengineer depending on how much CO2 is in the air, then that first country is strongly incented to cut emissions more than they otherwise would be. It's called the geoengineering threat. And I don't think it's simple, and I don't think it really means that there's not going to be, in the end, less mitigation, but I think it's not so black and white as you might think.
That was part one of A Case for Climate Engineering, a discussion with Harvard climate scientist David Keith. In his October 2013 book, published at MIT, he makes the case that global warming and CO2 pollution have become so severe that dramatic measures have to be researched immediately and applied by 2020. His method of choice is spraying sulfuric acid from airplanes. In spite of the Orwellian nature of the proposal, his colleague, MIT political scientist Kenneth Oyer, had little to say to challenge the project. Deeper concerns were expressed by MIT students, and you will hear from them when TUC Radio returns. One personal comment from me as producer. I want to express my opposition to a world where we deal with the catastrophe of CO2 pollution by unleashing a second global catastrophe, climate engineering and solar radiation management. Thanks to the Boston Review for the video of this discussion that was recorded on October 30th, 2013. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. You can get information on how to order a one-hour CD at cost on tucradio.org or by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio's mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Calpella, California, 95418. For more information, go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.